Ben Brown here. It's about 12 seconds after the hour this Monday, the 26th of June, on a Juno afternoon. We have some great guests today. Marion Call is here to talk about her new album release, which is going to be happening this week. Rasha McChesney is here to talk about a new podcast from Alaska's Energy Desk on Midnight Oil. And Mercedes Munoz will be here to highlight activities at the Canvas, in addition, of course, to Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, and everything else here on a Juno afternoon. Stay tuned after National Native News. We'll get going.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous Peoples Day will now be recognized in Alaska each October. Governor Bill Walker signed legislation over the weekend which officially designates the day under state law. Walker has previously issued proclamations for Indigenous Peoples Day on Columbus Day. Communities across the country are moving to celebrate the contributions of Indigenous people on the federal holiday. Alaska community members recently shared input on a National Native American Veterans Memorial. The National Museum of the American Indian is working to establish the memorial. KTOO's Trip Krause has more.
More than 86,000 Native Americans and Alaska Natives served in the armed forces in World War II and the Vietnam War, and about 31,000 currently are active duty, according to estimates by the Department of Defense. Eileen Maxwell is a spokesperson for the National Museum of the American Indian.
Native Americans are some of the most patriotic Americans in this country. And when their land is under danger or siege, they are the first to sign up.
An advisory committee and the museum have been conducting community consultations to seek input and support for the memorial and to find out what Native veterans want to see in a national tribute. Alaska Native veterans, community members, and museum representatives met recently at the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute in Juneau. Ozzie Shakely was one of the attendees. He commands the Southeast Alaska Native veterans and has researched and presented on Tlingit Code Talkers during World War II. The Code Talkers were trained Native soldiers who sent unbreakable codes based on indigenous languages.
So because of that, I really feel that we're a big part of especially World War II.
The museum estimates the budget for the memorial at $15 million, which includes long-term maintenance and associated educational programs.
So we just know it's going to be hard for them to make a choice because they meet with all the tribes. And, I mean, it'd be good if they recognize every tribe that there is. But because it's going to be a small area, they can't do that.
He says one idea is to include the various Code Talker medals. In Juneau, I'm Trip J. Krause.
The Burns Paiute tribe is calling on those expected to attend an upcoming rainbow gathering in Oregon to be respectful. The group known as the Rainbow Family of Living Light is being asked to respect the Burns Paiute tribe's cultural resources when people visit the Malheur National Forest in July. The group's proposed campsite is within the tribe's ancestral territory. The land is sacred to the Paiute people and holds archaeological and other cultural resources. The tribe says the federal government has a trust responsibility to protect the area, and the tribe is communicating with federal officials. The rainbow gathering is expected to draw thousands of people. Hundreds are already reportedly camped out. The event is scheduled for July 1st through the 7th. A monument near Virginia's capital will recognize the contributions of Native Americans. A groundbreaking was held over the weekend in Richmond. The monument, entitled Mantle, incorporates elements of the earth and is expected to take 2 years to complete. The Virginia Indian Commemorative Commission and the Virginia Capital Foundation hosted the groundbreaking ceremony. Officials in Madison, Wisconsin are considering a redesign of the city's flag. The Wisconsin State Journal reports this comes after concerns over cultural appropriation of a Native American sun symbol, which closely resembles Zia Pueblos in New Mexico. The flag, created in the 1960s, is blue and white with the sun symbol in the center. Members of the city's Native American community voice concerns about the flag. Officials are looking at ways to approach a redesign process. Family and friends celebrated the life of Apache musician A. Paul Ortega over the weekend in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The 79-year-old passed away in May. Ortega was also a tribal leader, advocate, and Mescalero Apache medicine man. Ortega was widely known as a pioneer in the Native American music industry. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Yate, the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the 2017 Navigation Insurance Safety and Health Conference, July 31st to August 2nd. Info on this event and services at siabq.org. Hakoanet.
Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at RamonaFarms.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It is almost 6 minutes after the hour, and today's Monday, the 26th of June. I'm Ben Brown, and you're listening to A Juno Afternoon. And Marion Call is our first guest this afternoon. Marion, welcome to A Juno Afternoon.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing great. I mean, it's a lovely stereotype-reinforcing Juno day out there.
I enjoy it. I'm happy.
I certainly didn't have to use the air conditioning driving anywhere today. So little things like that to be thankful for.
You know, I've been watching the weather in Arizona, where I'm going to be in a couple weeks.
Ooh.
And, yeah, I'm not eager to leave, let me tell you. This weather seems perfect to me when I look at traveling in the Southwest.
If I had to take mid-50s and drizzling or 120 and the plane can't fly, I think I'd probably have to go for the former.
Yep.
Yeah. So, and other good news, in addition to the weather, we've got good music going on here in Juno, and you have a new desk you're about to launch.
I do. I've been kind of, Juno's been lucky and on the inside of this. I've been sneaking tracks to Juno for a long time. I even made a bootleg CD at Folk Fest for everybody. But my new album, Standing Stones, is finally released, and this is a song I've been excited to share with people forever, and a record I've been excited to share with people forever. So I'm having a CD release party. I haven't been able to celebrate. I mean, I've been working on this for 2 years, this album, and it's finally here. I finally have CDs. So we're going to have a party at Amalca Distillery this Wednesday from 5 to 7, like first Friday hour. So we'll have some refreshments. The distillery will be open. We'll listen to some music and hang out. This is also the kickoff and sort of goodbye party for my grand tour, because now that the CD is done, I go on tour for 5 months. So I will be taking off, and I'll be back at Thanksgiving.
That's a pretty long tour.
It's a big tour. That's how my job works. I'm a musician, but instead of kind of hanging around and playing cafes and bars here, I go off all around the world, and that's my thing. So I'm going to miss it so much. Send me a postcard. and in the meantime, come out for the party. I would love to see everybody's faces and have a good time. Share a gin and tonic. Oh, man, they're doing good gin over there, and they're so friendly.
It is a neat place. So that's another new thing. A lot of listeners probably haven't had a chance to go to the Amalga Distillery yet.
Oh, that's true. Oh, my goodness.
I've actually been able to go there for two different events, both of which were super fun. The first one, I actually got a little tour of the distillery down in the basement, which was incredibly cool.
Oh, yeah.
But I do think the high point was either the Moscow Mule or the gin and tonic, or perhaps both.
I have never been into gin. I would not say I'm a gin person, but after tasting theirs, it's like it's a whole different experience. It's just a kind of a world of flavor. It takes a few seconds to unfold. So I've just even been drinking a straight gin and lime, which I never thought I would do in my life. It's amazing.
And so that's just one more reason to go to this event. But your disc, of course, is the result of two long years of work.
Two long years. A big Kickstarter, recording in four cities with musicians from all over the world. A Europe tour. It's been a big, big project. And doing some of it here in Juneau, too, in Betsy's Studio A and at home. And, I've been working my butt off on this. I'm so proud and happy it's finally done. They'll have it at, it's going to be at Rainy Retreat Books available. It's also going to be at the Alaska Robotics Gallery. I should bring it to the Jack, too. But, yeah, that's where the CD will be in my absence. You can also find the music on my website and on Spotify, iTunes, all that.
If people want to get a disc at the party on Wednesday, will there be copies of it
for
sale?
There will be copies of it for sale for slightly cheaper on Wednesday, because I'm going to eat the sales tax for all y'all on that one. I will pay it.
And, how cool.
They'll be there, and I am... it'll be my last chance to sort of scribble on them and draw pictures on them for you if you want. That's what I like to do.
Personalized copies of Marion's new disc. Now, you mentioned this really lengthy tour. Where is that? Where we talked a little bit. You're going to lovely Arizona in the summer.
You know, that's... That's how it works. You go to places where people want to be indoors in summer, and you play in Alaska where people want to be indoors in winter. So I'm sort of a reverse snowbird. I'll be starting in Austin. I'll be there for 2 weeks doing some recording and engineering work, and then I'm going to be traveling through the Southwest to San Diego and L.A. with stops in Albuquerque and Tucson. Then I zigzag up into Denver, Salt Lake, Boise, Missoula. Then I head east to I'll be in St. Louis for the eclipse. I'm doing an astronomy cast. It's a 4-day conference before the eclipse to hang out with a bunch of astronomers and play music. That'll be fun. And then up to the Midwest, and then we head up north to Ontario and Montreal, and then all the way down the eastern seaboard, back through the middle of the country again, and up the West Coast. So I'm in striking distance of all 50 states, or all 48 contiguous states, and I'm going to try to reward myself with some Hawaii next winter.
you'll have easily earned it. Now, do you have a bus you're traveling on?
No, I don't have a car right now. I'm going to buy one when I get to Texas in my first 2 weeks, and I will drive it around the country and then bring it back home to Juneau and probably sell it again because I don't need one here, really.
Well, that's exciting, and do you know what kind of car you're going to get, or are you going to just make that decision when you get to Texas?
We're looking. It's stressing me out. But the kind with a big trunk and is the compromise between big enough trunk and decent enough gas mileage to go on a tour. And I mean, that car will be my home for 5 months, basically. So, yeah.
You may want to think
fingers
about air conditioning.
Fingers crossed for a Subaru. Oh, who needs air conditioning?
Well, yeah.
In Arizona in summer? What
yeah,
are you talking?
Exactly. Put an ice cube on your, a bag of ice on your head and let it melt as you drive down
oh,
the road.
Yeah. Oh, it's so much fun. I get to see people I've known now. I've been touring 10 years now, and I get to see people all over the country that I now am friends with, and I've been watching their kids grow up and, you know, watching their businesses flourish or change or move, and, you know, oh, I used to see you in Dallas, now I see you in San Francisco, that's great. You know, it's this big kind of extended family. So, and this will probably be my last big road tour around the country. I'm going to keep touring, but I'm not doing this again, I think. So it's a grand finale tour, and I would love people in Juneau to come see me off, say hello, hear some tunes, eat some pretzels on this Wednesday afternoon from 5 to 7, so I can get a good taste of what I'll be missing the next few months and then be happy to come home again.
Absolutely. So the Amalga Distillery is right across from the Baranoff in Franklin Street.
It is. It's the old Juneau Empire / Capital City / AELP building.
Right. I think it's still called the AELP building.
It's a historic building.
And that's in the concrete, so you can't really change it when it's in concrete like that.
Well, they've done amazing things with the space if you haven't been in there yet. There's some controversial wallpaper that I think everyone in town is going to have a selfie in front of sooner or later. I love it. I'm a fan of the wallpaper and the gin, and of just hanging out there. It's great.
Now, if people are not going to plan to stay in Juneau the entire time that you're gone, and they want to think, maybe I'll be somewhere where Marianne's playing, is there on your website information about all your tour venues and dates?
There is. The rough dates are already all up at mariannecall.com. Just click on shows, and you can get an idea of when I will be where. Also, hey, tell a friend or relative. I'm sure no one in Juneau knows anyone outside, do they? No.
And so that's,
please tell people, send them. My concerts are small, so if a single person or a couple people or a family comes to one of my shows, they are statistically significant and very valuable, and we have a really good time. They're small, intimate concerts. It's great.
That sounds fun. So you mentioned that you did a European tour while you were putting this album together. Where did you go on that tour?
Mostly countries where a lot of people speak English, because that tends to be my fan base. I spent a lot of time in Germany, Netherlands, Austria, Switzerland, and the UK. I did not get to Scotland this trip. I did the trip before, and Ireland. So, yeah, I want to go all over the rest of Europe, too, but that's where most of my fans are.
Well, that's good. Well, you will have, again, probably after you've taken your well-earned Hawaii time after this tour, you'll have also earned another European tour.
I'm sure I have. I am planning on it, yes. But first, a good long stay back in Juneau.
Excellent. Well, I can guarantee you I will be at the Amalga Distillery between 5 and 7 on Wednesday. I wouldn't miss this. It sounds like it's going to be a wonderful disc. We're going to listen to some music in just a moment here. And I can speak from experience. The products they make at the distillery are great, and it's going to be great company. So it'd be foolish not to go.
Yeah, come on down.
All right. Well, anything else you'd like to share with our listeners on a Juneau afternoon?
Oh, while I'm gone, Juno, hang tight, you know, keep it together, and make sure you get out to some amazing, like, the concerts, the theater, the gallery walks, the community, the dancing, everything here. I just love it, and I hope that you guys will go to everything in my stead while I can't be here.
We will make sure it's arts, rich, and vibrant in your absence, and so it will be that way when you get back, I promise.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Okay, thank you, Mary and Call. Very good. Best wishes, and again, the party at the Amalga Distillery this Wednesday from 5 to 7, and here's the title track from Marion's album, which is titled
Standing Stones.
Thank you.
We drew nine lines from east to west. We drew nine from north to south. Then we stitched our names in concrete veins through miles and miles and miles of ground. Our names, if we scab and tear, if we line and spine and grind it, if we dare to try to sign it, but we were here, yes, we were here. Say the spirals and the roots, yes, we made beauty, it made sense sometimes in our better moments. So we were wild and we were wrong, and this is how our portrait's drawn. So sculpt and sketch and sign. Just like so, to map the stars' ascent, to prove we understood the moon, we left circles where she went. The triangle unlocked for us to babble of our doubts, and then we wrangled fire and rocketeered our stakes back to the stars.
Gentlemen, was Marion Call's new title track from her new album, Standing Stones. And I'll just say it one more time. She's having a launch party for that at the Amalga Distillery this Wednesday. And so think about that. We'll play some more of her music in a little bit here. But now we have Rasha McChesney here to tell us about a new podcast from Alaska's Energy Desk. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should mention that I am on the board of Alaska Public Media,
uh-huh.
And the Energy Desk is part of our news department.
Uh-huh.
So if there's any conflict there, you know, you heard it here first.
Absolutely.
Okay, so Rasha, tell us about Midnight Oil.
Well, so the first thing I should say is that for those of you who are older than 30, you probably remember the Australian band Midnight Oil that did that song, Beds Are Burning. We know, we remember, we had this conversation. You should go listen to that song. It's hugely entertaining. Nothing to do with what we're doing. This podcast that we're working on is it's a deep dive into the history of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. So we're looking at how the pipeline itself, the fight to build the pipeline, and the sort of the impact of the pipeline has shaped the state. And we're telling those stories through an 8-episode podcast. The first episode dropped last Tuesday. We've got one coming out tomorrow. There will be 6 more after this. You can find it really on any podcast app that you use. Just look for Midnight Oil. That's what we're doing.
Now, if I recall correctly, there was a call to Alaskans to maybe get in touch with the reporters to tell their stories, because you knew that if you just went and did it on your own, you might not find everything that was out there, but that you wanted to get Alaskans who thought, hey, I've got a pipeline story to tell to be part of this.
Absolutely, and we're still looking for those stories. I think the best way for people to find we have sort of a couple of links all over Twitter and all over Facebook, but I think the easiest way would be to go to the Alaska Energy Desk Facebook page. We've got a little link pinned there to the top of the page. We are still looking for your stories, and actually in the 6 months that it's taken to develop and report out this project, we've run into more people who know someone who knows someone or is related to someone or worked on the pipeline themselves. Everyone has a pipeline story, and we want to hear from you if you live in a town that was a boom town when it happened, or if you worked along the pipeline. We're very interested in what people have to say.
You know, I was born in Anchorage in 1967 and was there for the better part of the 70s. And so I didn't work on the pipeline, but it was going on all around me. And Anchorage is such a different place now than it was back then. So there are probably some stories that, like you said, are 1, 2, 3 degrees of separation from the actual pipeline worker.
Absolutely. Anchorage, actually, you know, we had a really earnest conversation about if we should do a podcast episode about how Anchorage looks now and why that happened, because so much of that city was built in a boom period. So you have this sort of sprawling, industrialized looking city that, you know, a lot of that happened when we just had this influx of 70,000 people in 3 years going to build the state, and they just had to build things as rapidly as possible, and then they left all of that behind, and voila, beautiful Anchorage.
Yeah, if you wonder why Spinard is so beautifully, seamlessly integrated into the rest of Anchorage, there's the answer to some of those answers are in that story, absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
So have you been pretty impressed by some of the stories you've already had from people who've decided to reach out and share what they remember?
Oh, impressed is, I can't even begin to tell you how entertaining it's been to, a really good example. I sat down with the Lieutenant Governor, Byron Mallott, a few weeks ago, and I swear to you that he did his best John Wayne impression while he was talking about the formations of the Alaska Federation of Natives and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And for those of us who are new to this state, I've been here for almost 5 years, which is not long. For those of us who are new to this state, it's really sort of this immediate and visceral painting of a picture of all of these things that we know about. We all know that the pipeline is there. We all know that, yes, it was a big construction project. But to hear from the people who were down in it in the trenches talking about what it was like, I drove up the Hall Road with Diane Benson, who is a professor at UAF now, but back in her pipeline days when she was 19 years old, she was a Teamster, and she drove trucks as they were building the pipeline, and she has these crazy stories about, you know, baiting bears into places to get guys to leave her alone. Mm-hmm. And I mean, just, so we have heard so many stories like that. You know, there's the shame totem in Valdez. Have you ever heard of that?
Well, actually I haven't. I've been to Valdez many, many times. Where's the shame totem?
It's in this guy's front yard.
Okay.
I haven't been there. My coworker Rachel Waldholt has, you'll hear it in our episode about, the Exxon Valdez. There's a guy, the best that I understand is there's a guy who built a shame totem and said he would only take it down, when full amends had been made, and they haven't been. So it's been there for,
That actually, I used to go to the theater conference in Valdez every summer, you know, so I've gone to 20 of 28 of them. And so, of course, when you close down the pipeline club, you don't necessarily remember everything that you see on the way home.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, that's sounding vaguely familiar. So mental note to self, look for Shame
go
Totem
look
next
for the
time in Valdez.
Shame Totem.
Well, apropos of that, I imagine you're going to get some stories, because this is a podcast that's not being broadcast. You don't have to edit it for you know, prime time.
Right.
So if you get a really salacious story of the wild, wild west aspects of the pipeline, you would be able to run with that.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. So don't be afraid. If you've got something you don't think could go on the air, it's a podcast. Don't be afraid.
We want to know it all.
That's right.
Everything you've never told. But I will say that one of the cool things about this project is that, you know, we pitched it to NPR, and they funded it. They gave us $10,000. They helped with travel and editing. They took a couple of reporters, got lucky enough that we got to fly to D.C. and hang out at the public radio mothership for a couple days. And it really helped to shape the story, too, because, you know, there are things that we know about as Alaskans that people in the outside and in the lower 48, I mean, there were people there that didn't know that we had an oil-based economy, which is bonkers to me. So when we were sort of shaping these stories, it was like, well, Alaska has such a transient population. Is it possible that the people that we're telling these stories to don't know what the Native Claims Settlement Act, don't know what AFN is, don't know, you know, they probably know about the Exxon Valdez, but did they know that you can still go down to the beach there and kick up oil in the sand? You know, like, it, so there were a lot of things that it sort of opened our eyes to going and doing that training. So NPR has funded it. And then, of course, the Energy Desk itself is funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So we've had all of this support to do this kind of deep dive into something that I think is hugely important for people to understand the conversations that we have going on now about the state's budget and what we're going to do. And is this a post-oil world? And it's just been, it's been an interesting trip.
And it's not over yet is the great thing. So you're still actively curating stories,
yes,
soliciting information from folks. If you want to get involved, go. So there's a Facebook page, and mm-hmm, it's probably also on the Alaska Public Media page.
Yes, okay. Absolutely. Yep. So you can find Alaska's Energy Desk both on KTOO's homepage. KTOO is actually the sort of home desk for Alaska's Energy Desk. We have reporters all over the state and on Alaska and Anchorage and here, but it's, the hub is in Juneau. So you can find the Energy Desk on KTOO's page. You can find it on the Alaska Public Media page. It's, we're kind of everywhere at this point, all over Twitter.
Just like hydrocarbons.
Yeah.
They're everywhere.
Everywhere.
Well, excellent. So this is Midnight Oil. It's a new podcast, an 8-part series. Two of them are in the can, 6 more to go.
Mm-hmm.
And it's...
Well, now, actually, so the next one is coming out tomorrow, drops Tuesday.
So you've got I hope that's in the can.
You've got it. To be very honest, I definitely revoiced a few parts of that this morning,
okay,
but it should be in the can this afternoon.
All right, you're not pulling an all-nighter.
I'm not. That was last week. I think you have a promo for that episode hanging out that you could probably play for people.
I think I will do that, and I think just in the interest of flashing back to fun music from decades ago, I might play the song Beds Are Burning.
Oh, Lord.
I mean, someone queued it up for me. I can't even take
and
the credit for it.
You have to do it.
That's right. All right, well, this is a Juneau afternoon. It's about 28 minutes after the hour. We've been talking to Rasha McChesney from Alaska's Energy Desk about the new podcast,
mm-hmm,
Midnight Oil. And it's a work in progress. So listen to it, download it, think about it. And then if you have a story to share, or if you know someone, you know, if you're Great Uncle Joe told you some crazy pipeline stories when you were a kid, call him up and say, hey, I've got something fun for you to do, Uncle Joe, and make him share it with the rest of the world.
Yes, it's incumbent upon you.
Well, because it really is important. You know, as you said a moment ago, Rasha, Alaska has changed so much. Even someone who's lived here his whole life like I have, you can forget what it used to be like, and it's really good to remember that because it's going to affect who we are going into the future. So it's for everyone to learn and know about.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Thank you so much, Rasha.
Thank you.
Alaska became a state in 1959, and the federal government agreed to hand over more than 100 million acres. There was just one problem. Alaska Native people already claimed that land. For Willie Hensley, the issue was personal.
And so I knew that we had to stop it because... If we didn't stop it, the land was actually going to be gone forever. We were never going to get it back.
Then Alaska struck oil, and the question of who owned what land in the 49th state went all the way to the White House. To hear the full story, check out Midnight Oil, the new podcast and series from Alaska's Energy Desk.
River broke, the blood was Support comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, offering artisan coffees, fresh baked goods, salads, sandwiches, and more at their downtown and Glacier cafes. More information at heritagecoffee.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 26th of June, 2017. 1997, on this date, an unemployed single mother named Joanne Rowling sat on a train and got the idea for a book about a black-haired, bespectacled boy who was a wizard and was just finding out about it, the beginning of the seven Harry Potter books. It's the birthday of the blues musician Big Bill Brunsey, born in Scott, Mississippi in 1898. It's the birthday of Walter Farley, born Syracuse, New York, 1916, who always wanted a horse when he was a boy, but his parents could not afford one. So he started writing stories about horses. And while he was a student at Columbia, he wrote a novel, The Black Stallion, story of a boy and a wild horse who survive a shipwreck and become friends on a deserted island. The book sold so well that Walter Farley went on to write 20 more novels about horses. And it's the birthday of Pearl S. Buck, born Hillsborough, West Virginia, 1892. Her parents were missionaries in China. She was raised there from the age of 3 months. She spoke Chinese first, said she did not consider herself a white person when she was a child, spent the afternoons with her beloved Chinese nurse, took her to visit friends where the child listened to women gossip. Pearl Buck married a missionary. They lived in northern China and then Nanking. In 1920, she gave birth to a daughter, Carol, who had a severe developmental disability. She would scream and cry for hours on end. By the winter of 1927, Buck was living in Shanghai. She had just finished the manuscript of her first novel, and the manuscript had been destroyed by looters. Her marriage was deteriorating. Her husband did not want to leave China. Pearl Buck knew that the only hope of giving her daughter long-term care was to go to the United States. She had to figure out a way to provide for her, so she returned to writing. She moved to America with her daughter. She published her first novel, East Wind, West Wind, in 1930, and started work on her second novel, which took her just 3 months. Pearl Buck was amazed when the second novel was chosen by the Book of the Month Club, and she got a check for $4,000, enough money to pay for several years of her daughter's schooling. The second novel was The Good Earth. It sold nearly 2 million copies in its first year, and Pearl Buck won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1938. Here's a poem for today by Ann Iverson entitled Plentitude. Even near the very end, the frail cat of many years came to sit with me among the glitter of bulb and glow, tried to the very last to drink water and love her small world, would not give up on her curious self. And though she staggered, shriveled, and weak, still she poked her nose through ribbon and wrap, and her peace and her sweetness were of such that when I held my ear to her heart, I could hear the sea. Plentitude, a poem by Ann Iverson from Mouth of Summer, published by Kelsey Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into challenging games. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by Staples. Staples offers copy and print solutions for businesses, from color copies to presentations to promotional products. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, it's pro time. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for this station comes from the Breeze Inn Lemon Creek, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily with a selection of baked goods, hot sandwiches, burritos, soups, and more. Menus online at breezeinn.com.
And it is about 39 minutes after the hour. I'm Ben Brown. Today is Monday, the 26th of June, and this is a Juno afternoon. And our next guest today is Mercedes Munoz, who is here to highlight some activities at the Canvas. So welcome, Mercedes, to a Juno afternoon.
Thank you so much, Ben.
And just let's start from the basics for our listeners. There may be some folks from out of town who don't know what the Canvas is. They don't even know what REACH is. So let's explain that from the get-go.
Okay. Well, the Canvas is under the umbrella of REACH, which is a nonprofit organization that helps individuals who experience developmental disabilities through all stages of their life. And like I said, the Canvas is under that umbrella. So our focus is on the arts and the inclusion of arts with adults with developmental disabilities and the community members that we serve as well. So we have lots of events and classes and open studios, all kinds of opportunities at the Canvas for everyone here in Juneau.
And so it's not just for the disabled population. It really is for the whole community with a focus on people with disabilities.
We definitely serve artists with disabilities. We have Dayhab classes during the day, but those are also open. We have our open studio program, so we would encourage community members to come in and participate at that during that time as well. So absolutely, we have lots of programming for everyone.
So let's talk about the Open Studio program. How do people learn about the offerings? How frequent are they, and how formal is the sign-up or the enrollment process?
Okay. So our Open Studios are pretty much the same all the time. You can come in and sign up any month. We do month-long programs. We have a separate one for our pottery studio, and then we have a separate studio membership program for our drawing, painting, printmaking studio, but that we have a lot more than that. You can also, we have the materials to work with jewelry making and glass cutting, so there's the possibilities are endless in that room too. So those are the two open studio programs we have. Then we also offer classes throughout the year. Right now, this summer, for adults, we're focusing on some shorter one-day workshops, so I wanted to tell you about a few of those that we have coming
up.
We just finished a really fun one, a silk painting class with a local artist named David Riccio. That was really fun. And we have a few more coming up this summer. Again, all of these are going to be just one-day classes. We know that people don't have the time to commit to a four-week class in the summertime, so we focus on those more in the fall and spring, and then in the summer just keep it short with the one-day workshops. So the next one we have coming up is actually this Saturday, and it's going to be with a traveling artist and arts activist, Lindsay Karen, and she's a fantastic teacher. She's teaching a kids class right now, and then on Saturday she's going to be teaching a figure drawing and ink class, and that's going to be with a live model. And so definitely you can find more information on that class on our website along with all our other classes. We also have a printmaking class coming up in August with the local artist Jim Human. And then, as always, we'll have a beginning wheel throwing class with our ceramic studio manager, Alex Botello, and that's coming up in July. And he's a fantastic teacher as well. All our teachers are fantastic.
And ceramics are near and dear to your heart. That's a medium in which you're actually quite a successful artist.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I love ceramics, and I am lucky enough to be able to work in a place that I can, you know, take a break and pop into the ceramic studio. It's fun.
So the one-day courses, how long is a one-day course? What time in the morning do those start, or is it the same
right
for each one?
Most of them are, we have a couple that are 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. and a couple that are 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. So it kind of just depends on the class and how long the project is going to take. But all the information is on our website. So if you visit our website, canvasarts.org, you can look under workshops and see all the information, the date, time, price, and description for each class. And then one other option that we have for classes, and this goes all year round, but This isn't something that we have advertised until just recently, but we can always do a custom class as well. So if you have a minimum of four people and you have a subject that you really want to learn about, if we have the teacher for it, we can really schedule it whenever works for you within our availability. And then also if it's something we don't have a teacher for, we can definitely look into that and try to find a class that can work for you. So
four people, that's a pretty small class. The ones that are part of the regular curriculum, those classes are probably a little bigger than four people, I'm going to guess.
Yeah, our classes, typically we cap at 12.
Okay.
So we try to keep them pretty small, pretty intimate, so that we can really have that quality one-on-one instruction, or, you know, closer to one-on-one instruction with a teacher. The more time with the instructor, the better.
And 12 is not an oversized class by any stretch. Now, I know some of my acting colleagues at Perseverance do some work at the Canvas as well.
Yeah.
And but that's not really for the general public. That's more for the target population.
Right. So they actually just helped some of our artists who experience disabilities work on a play telling their story.
Mm-hmm.
It was very cool. So, yeah, they came in and worked with our artists on that project. And I think they plan to do it again next year. So.
Enrique and Tom Robidoff. Enrique Bravo and Tom Robidoff.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, when I was into Kill a Mockingbird with them, they were always talking about the fun that they had had that day, you know, when they were working over there with the students.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah, no, I know everybody that we work with had a great time with them, too.
And so Reach, of course, the Canvas also tends to be a part of the regular First Friday art scene and has shows. And is that going to continue going into through the summer and into the fall?
Yeah, absolutely. We have this coming First Friday, we have a show that is going to be done by one of our Canvas artists. Her name is Annie Eichhorst, and the name of her show is Point in Time. And she's been working on this body of work for 3 years now, and it's fantastic. It's just something you definitely have to see in person. It's wonderful.
And that's coming up first Friday in July.
Yes, so that will be next week. Can't believe that's already next week.
And it's going to be a crazy busy week because Monday's the 3rd, so nothing's going to get done except preparing for the party on the 4th, and everyone recovers on the 5th. And next thing you know, it's Friday the 7th, and it's First Friday.
Exactly.
That's wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
So canvasarts.org is the website.
Yes.
And is it possible, is it interactive? Could people register on the website, or they just get the info there, and then they call up and take care of getting signed up for a class?
They can sign up on the website as well.
Sign up
right there, or if you have any questions, you can call 586-1750, and we can answer any questions you have on that. And we're also right now working on making lots of products to sell and lots of gallery items like journals and scarves and pillowcases with all of our artists' images on them. And so our artists are paid a licensing fee for those images. So any product that you see in our gallery and soon to be on our website, too, some of those proceeds will go to our artists as well.
That's excellent. I mean, because, you know, we talk about the economic benefits of the arts, but that's really putting that theory into action.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're helping some people that, for any artist, it might be difficult to do on his or her own, and so you're really helping some people who can use the help, benefit financially and creatively from the process.
Yeah.
Well,
absolutely.
Done. So you like working where you work?
Yes, I love working at the Canvas.
I can tell.
It is a very fun place to be. I'm coming up on 3 years, which I can't believe it's already been 3 years. It's very fun. I started off at the front desk, and then I was the pottery studio manager, and I'm the artistic coordinator. So I've been in, feel like, almost every side of the Canvas.
Right.
So it's been awesome.
And do you still have time for your own creative process? Are you able to put on a show of your own work anytime? Or, I mean, that takes time, I know, to build up enough things to do a show.
I'm trying. I have a show in December at the City Museum, so I really got to make time for it now.
When you talk about time flying, I think it was maybe one of your first shows at Annie Kale's. This was 4 or 5 years ago, and I just remember you did very, very well. They responded very well to the pieces, and a lot of them had moved just on that first Friday. So
thank you.
So you got to, and that's the important thing, you know, any of us who are creative and we do other things in the world, we got to make sure we keep time for our own art, our own creation.
Absolutely, yeah, and that's one thing that I just love about working at the Canvas is getting to see these artists every day making wonderful work and being supported by other artists, and just having that dialogue with each other is fantastic.
Excellent. So Mercedes Munoz, artistic coordinator for the Canvas at Reach. Any other thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners on a Juno afternoon?
You know, I think that's it. Just definitely come to the show next First Friday. It'll be great.
And then go online and learn about it. Maybe you want to take a one-day course and become a little more artistic yourself.
Yeah, one-day course, or we have kids' classes, or if you have anything you want to learn about, just give us a call and we'll try to make it happen.
Very good. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Mercedes.
Yeah, thank you too, Ben.
This is Bird Note. In a beautiful, dramatic, and at times deadly aerial ballet, a peregrine falcon dives on a flock of shorebirds, dunlins. Seeking escape, the dunlins flash white and dark, rippling through the sky. Recent years have seen dramatic changes in this dance. Since the banning of the pesticide DDT in 1973, peregrine numbers have increased dramatically on both the Atlantic and Pacific coasts. In response, dunlins have adapted. For one thing, they've gotten lighter and faster, according to Dr. Ron Eidenberg and his colleagues at Simon Fraser University in British Columbia. To avoid vulnerable roosting, dunlins are spending an average of 3 more hours each day in the air. Their response to heightened danger has substantially reduced their reserves of fat. And when feeding, birds in the West are gathering more frequently on wide-open mudflats and avoiding enclosed tidal inlets. As Eidenberg puts it, the dunlins are defending their survival in a variety of ways that trade off food, rest, and safety. And in reviewing 30 years of research, he's seen no persistent sharp decline in dunlin numbers. As to whether succeeding generations of dunlin will continue to adapt to be lighter, faster, and more often in flight, only time will tell.
My ankles cross, my shoulders worry, boy.
4th of July with lightning right above and fireworks below. Oh, something possessed the Midwestern summer.
Alaska became a state in 1959, and the federal government agreed to hand over more than 100 million acres. There was just one problem. Alaska Native people already claimed that land. For Willie Hensley, the issue was personal.
And so I knew that we had to stop it, because if we didn't stop it, the land was actually going to be gone forever. We were never going to get it back.
Then Alaska struck oil, and the question of who owned what land in the 49th state went all the way to the White House. To hear the full story, check out Midnight Oil, the new podcast and series from Alaska's Energy Desk.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up words and phrases and clauses.
Conjunction, junction, how's that function?
I got three favorite cars, get most of my job done.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
I got and, but, and, or, they'll get you pretty far.
And,
that's additive, like this and that.
But,
that's sort of the opposite, not this, but that.
Oh.
And then there's or, for when you have a choice, this or that. And, button, or get you pretty far.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up two boxcars and making them run right. Milk and honey, bread and butter, peas and rice.
Hey, that's nice.
Dirty but happy, digging and scratching, losing your shoe and a button or two. Poor but honest, sad but true.
Boo hoo hoo. Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up phrases and clauses, the balance like. Out of the frying pan and into the fire. He could loose the sandbags, but the balloon wouldn't go any higher. Let's go up to the mountains or down to the sea. You should always say thank you, or at least.
At least say please.
Uh-huh.
Conjunction, junction, watch that function. Gonna get you there.
Ooh.
If you're very careful.
Oh.
Conjunction, junction, watch that function. Gonna get you there. If you're very careful.
If
conjunction, junction, watch that function.
You're very careful.
And that was Marion Call, Conjunction Junction, Marion Call and Friends from a concert on the 22nd of April. And stay tuned now for the news.